You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. The U.S. Constitution was once a roadmap for young nations working to establish their own democracies. But our country has undergone massive demographic, economic, and political changes since its birth. In a new book, our guest says our constitutional order is at a breaking point where resistance to multiracial democracy and institutions that allow for control by a reactionary minority could take us from representative government to authoritarianism. But he says it's not too late to change things. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Where do you think the founding fathers got it right or wrong when they wrote the Constitution? Are you worried about the risk of authoritarian rule in the U.S.? Is it time to change things like the Electoral College, the U.S. Senate, court appointments? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Steve Levitsky is the David Rockefeller Professor of Latin American Studies and Government at Harvard University. He co-authored the New York Times bestseller, How Democracies Die. His newest book, he's also the co-author, is called Tyranny of the Minority, Why American Democracy Reached the Breaking Point. Steve, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Before we go under the hood and take a look at the Constitution, can you talk about recent evidence in the United States, I think especially in the aftermath of the 2020 election, of your concerns of Democratic backsliding in this old democracy?
Sure. We in the United States are not accustomed to experiencing Democratic backsliding. We've had a pretty stable constitutional order for a very long time, certainly any of our lifetimes. You have to go back to the Civil War to see any sort of rupture of the constitutional order. But just about every international monitor or index of democracies, organizations that monitor the level of democracy across the world, all of them registered a pretty significant decline in the level of democracy in the United States beginning in 2016. Just to take one example, Freedom House, which is a U.S.-based organization that monitors democracy across the world, 10 years ago has a global freedom index that ranges from zero, dictatorships like North Korea, to 100, which is a handful of democracies. And a decade ago, the United States got a pretty good score, 94, which put it on par with Germany and UK, Canada, Japan. But now it is down to, it has fallen from 94 to 83, which is still a democracy, but less democratic, according to Freedom House, than Mongolia and Argentina. And that's pretty shocking to many Americans. But when you have violent threats against election workers, violent threats against elected officials, prosecutors, when you have an effort by an incumbent president to overturn the results of an election, you fall to the point where Freedom House considers you less democratic than Argentina. So democracy has not died in the United States, but it has backslid in the last 6 or 7 years.
You point out in the book a key feature of a successful representative government is that parties are willing to lose, that they can recognize, okay, we lost, we need to change our message, come back in 4 years or 3 years or whatever that country's particular time range is. And there's a fear in the book that that's no longer the case, that we no longer accept that we might lose and we might look for alternate non-election related means to not lose.
Sure. So this is the cardinal rule of democracy, is that parties, all political parties that participate in a democracy, must be willing to accept defeat, accept the results of elections, win or lose. We actually in the book lay out three very simple criteria to determine whether a political party is committed to democracy. Basically, what the political scientist Juan Linz called loyal Democrats, parties that are committed to democracy, have to do three basic things. One of them I just mentioned, they have to accept the results of elections. Another one, very basic, is they must always unambiguously renounce political violence. And third, maybe most importantly of all, they need to break publicly and thoroughly wash their hands of all extremist anti-democratic forces, particularly those in their own camp, on their own flank. Unfortunately, looking at the Republican Party since 2016, but especially since 2020, the bulk of the party leadership is failing on all three of those criteria.
And those are symptoms, if I'm reading your book right, of two big changes or two big concerns. First of all, Steve, you and your co-authors say we're on the verge of something unprecedented in some ways, the rise of a functioning multiracial democracy. But at the same time, you see a backlash, a reaction to that.
Yeah. The story in our book is not entirely bleak. It's not all bad news. There's some really good news that the United States has been over the last half century, but really, especially in the last couple of decades, has been approaching something really quite unique and quite distinctive, which is a truly multiracial democracy. And in fact, we are about to become the first democracy in history, if we manage to make it through, in which a dominant ethnic group loses its numerical majority and its dominant status in society. That's a really big shift. It's a really big change. It is, I think, been much more consequential than most of us anticipated. That's why, at least in the argument in the book, that's why we're sort of in this storm that we're in right now. Because it's not easy for a dominant ethnic group to lose its dominance, 200 years of dominance. But if we get there, and I think we will become one of the world's few multiracial democracies, and ideally can be a model for the rest of the world. The problem is that there has, in fact, we shouldn't have been surprised perhaps, but been a pretty intense reaction. Groups that have been sitting at the top of economic, social, cultural, political hierarchies for decades don't necessarily like those hierarchies being challenged.
Talking to Steve Levitsky, co-author of the new book, Tyranny of the Minority, Why American Democracy Reached the Breaking Point. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Steve, before we go to our callers, one of the fundamental concerns you have in your book is that our Constitution was state of the art in a lot of ways when it came into being. But you see a lot of countries making more progress in advancing their constitutions, making them more democratic. And we're stuck, you say, with a lot of institutions that allow a small group to hold on to power. What are some of your main concerns?
Yeah, I mean, the good news is that authoritarian forces in the United States, which I would characterize as, say, the MAGA forces, are not and have never been a majority of Americans, and they haven't been a majority of the electorate or voters. The problem is that our institutions, our pretty unique institutions, allow them to thwart electoral majorities and sometimes even govern over electoral majorities. The United States is the only presidential democracy in the world where the loser of a presidential election can win the presidency. We are the only democracy in the world where a partisan minority in the Senate can systematically and permanently block legislation, regular legislation, that's supported by a majority. We have one of the most malapportioned Senates on earth, a Senate in which you get equal representation no matter what the population of your state. So we represent land, not people. That is fundamentally not democratic. And we're the only democracy in the world where Supreme Court justices have lifetime tenure security, where there isn't either term limits or retirement age. So all of this allows, in a way that exists in no other democracy, allows partisan minorities in some circumstances to either at the very least thwart, but in many cases actually rule over majorities. And as you said, we had a very, very progressive constitution at the outset. We were far and away the most democratic country on earth when the Constitution was written. But other democracies over the course of more than 100 years, especially the 20th century, gradually democratized their senates, established term limits on the Supreme Court. In Latin America, other presidential democracies eliminated their electoral college. So they gradually took steps to make their systems more democratic. We did too, of course. We expanded the suffrage. We in the early 20th century, we began to directly elect the Senate. We have also taken steps to democratize our system over the course of a couple hundred years. But in the last half century, we've kind of stopped doing that work. We've stopped doing the work of working to make our system democratic, more democratic. And as a result, we've fallen behind other established democracies.
Let's bring in a caller now. Tom is with us in Madison. Tom, hello.
Steve, I couldn't agree more. Perhaps if we appointed you dictator, you could resolve all of these issues for us. But we have so many problems. We have a gerontocracy in the United States Senate. We have the Electoral College, which is outdated and obsolete. We have the power of incumbency, making these jobs a virtual sinecure for, you know, Congress and Senate, and these people stay in there for years, and you can't tell me that there's not one single person in their district to challenge them and have bring in some new ideas. I lived in Ireland, and we had a system of proportional representation, multi-seat constituencies, and single transferable vote.
Tom, thanks for the call. You've already given us a lot to talk about there. Steve, you had mentioned your concerns about the Electoral College in the book, something along the lines of proportional representation. You would agree with Tom on.
Yeah, well, first of all, let me make clear, not only do I not think anybody should be dictator, but I would be an especially bad dictator. Let me make that clear. You don't want me as dictator. That said, we in the final chapter of our book have a list of 15 proposed institutional reforms. One of them is to abolish the Electoral College. Another one is to replace our first-past-the-post electoral system with a system of proportional representation more similar to what exists in most European democracies. And that would eliminate the possibility of gerrymandering and make it much less likely that politicians can sort of, first of all, carve out their own district with an electorate that suits them, and then maintain themselves in power because it's very difficult to challenge them. A proportional representation system, again, it avoids gerrymandering, it avoids the kind of manufactured majorities and supermajorities that you get in the Wisconsin legislature, and would avoid the re-election over and over and over again of individual legislatures.
Thanks for that call, Tom. We're talking to Steve Levitsky, co-author of the new book, Tyranny of the Minority, Why American Democracy Reached the Breaking Point. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the ideas, the suggested changes you've heard so far? Are there other changes you'd like to see to make American government work better? However you define that, be more democratic, however you define that. Join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Steve Levitsky, co-author of the new book, Tyranny of the Minority, Why American Democracy Reached the Breaking Point. Back to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Jeff is with us in Superior now. Jeff, hi.
Yeah, good afternoon. I couldn't disagree more with one of the things your guest said here today. I switched from the Democratic Party to the Republican Party because of the Second Amendment. We have the right as a people to bear arms and replace our government if it does not responsive to or represent our needs. That's the purpose of the Second Amendment, is to maintain that right to bear arms and overthrow our government. In fact, Gandhi said the only time nonviolence really is effective is when you have the option to choose violence.
Jeff, thanks for the call. Steve, I don't know if that's the right reading of the original Second Amendment.
Yeah, I'm going to say that nowhere in the Constitution does it say that we have a right to overthrow the government via arms. I'm just going to go out and say that.
There's a lot of argument about the history of the Second Amendment and why it was one of the guaranteed liberties. At best, Jeff's point, I think, is controversial.
Yeah, I think it's wrong.
Okay. Thanks for calling in, Jeff. We'll go now to Nancy in Milwaukee. Nancy, hi.
Hello. I think it's really imperative that at the present time we try to change the Constitution so that the term of presidency is one term only. That would nicely eliminate the incumbency, and I think that one term should be 6 years in length, because at the present time and ever before in the past, every president spends the last 2 years of the first term running for the second term. And all that time, energy, and money and enthusiasm would therefore be spent on the work that America needs done and the world needs done, because he can't run for a second term. There is no second term.
Nancy, thanks for the call. And that's basically the Mexican presidential system, Steve. 1 6-year term. I've seen concerns that people argue that gives too much power to the party that picks each successive president. What do you think of Nancy's suggestion?
Well, you stole my line there. I'm supposed to be a specialist in Latin America.
Sorry.
So I was gonna say that that's precisely the system that they have in Mexico. It's an interesting and a plausible idea. I prefer a U.S. style two-year term system. I would not advocate for changing that. Because I think that it's true that the president spends the last year thinking a lot about re-election, but that's not necessarily a bad thing. It's re-election that gets it's the pursuit of re-election that keeps our politicians honest, that keeps our politicians responsive, hopefully, to voters. And arguably, or what I fear, is that a president not facing re-election would be even less responsive to voters than they are now. 6 years, I've seen arguments made for it. Other democracies have experimented with it. Mexico's done it for decades and decades. It's certainly doable. My fear there is that sometimes presidents fail and really need to be just don't do well and lose public support, lose public consensus, and they become lame ducks. And if you become a failed president in your second or third year, it's a long way to get to 6 years. And we've seen in some countries that those last couple of years can be pretty traumatic if there's no mechanism to remove a failed president.
Thanks for the call, Nancy. Talking to Steve Levitsky, co-author of the new book, Tyranny of the Minority, Why American Democracy Reached the Breaking Point. John is with us now in Oshkosh. John, hello.
Hello. I have a question. I guess I just want to make sure we're talking on the right terms. I've always understood that we are not a democracy, a true democracy. We're a constitutional republic. Is that correct?
Partially. We are certainly a republic, which means that we are not a monarchy. When the founders talked about a republic, what they meant, every major country in the world at the time of the U.S. founding was a monarchy. It was the only system really existing in the West. And so creating a system that was in which the government was selected by the people and not through hereditary succession was a dramatic change. And that's a system that was called a republic. It was a system of rule by the people. Now, democracy in the founders' minds back in the 18th century meant pure majority rule. It meant direct democracy, rule by the masses. That's never what we were. It's not what we became. What we think of as democracy today is something very different. When I say the word democracy, I mean representative democracy. I mean a system where the people elect representatives that rule us. I also mean liberal democracy, a democracy in which majority rule is tempered by minority rights, basic civil rights, so that at whatever government we elect cannot take from me my right to free speech, my right to associate, my right to assembly, my right to publish, my right to religious practice. So a modern democracy, what we call democracy in Sweden, in Uruguay, in Costa Rica, in Germany, in the UK, Canada, New Zealand, the United States, is a liberal representative democracy, a system of majority rule, but in which we indirectly rule, the people rule indirectly by electing representatives, and the people have their basic civil liberties protected. That is what journalists, politicians, political scientists all call modern democracy, and it's been that way for a century or so.
Thanks for the call, John. Greg in Toma couldn't stay on the line, but brings up a point. He says the Constitution is based in part on ethics and people's obligation to do the right thing. We run into problems, Greg says, when people stray away from that. And you talk in the book, Steve, about our reliance on norms and what happens when people find things that are norms but not necessarily laws and start to exploit them. What are solutions to that?
Right. That is absolutely right. There is no Constitution, no set of rules, no set of laws that simply by writing them down on paper can automatically make a society function well. A democracy must have good rules, must have a good constitution. We do have a good constitution. But any society, in order for democracy to work well, must have a set of informal rules, unwritten rules, norms that guide the way that we behave. And in How Democracies Die, we spent a lot of time discussing how in the 20th century, U.S. democracy was sustained by a set of informal norms in which politicians recognized that even though legally there were certain lines they could cross, that they shouldn't do it. And those norms have been breaking down. And I think even since we published How Democracies Die 5 years ago, 6 years ago, those norms have corroded even further, and which is why our politics, if you compare it to when I was growing up in, say, the 1980s, the 1990s, our politics are now much more of a sort of no-holds-barred contest in which anything can happen. You can try to impeach the president for anything. You can refuse to let the president fill a Supreme Court vacancy. You can investigate the president for anything. You can shut down the government. It's by any means necessary politics. And that one is a function of the erosion of our norms of self-restraint. And two, leads to unstable, ineffective democracy that is going to threaten our power, our prestige, our place in the world.
Steve, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That's Steve Levitsky, co-author of the new book, Tyranny of the Minority, Why American Democracy Reached the Breaking Point. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We want to hear from you now about TV. Is there an old television show you've just started watching lately, or is there a show that you have rewatched once or a whole bunch of times? Call in now and tell us about it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Well, what brings this up now? Well, you know, between TV and all the streaming channels and apps out there, seems like we've never had more new shows to pick from or a bigger back catalog of older shows we can watch. That means some shows are getting a second life on streaming. You may have seen in the news this drama series, Suits, aired its last episode in 2019. I didn't notice it at the time, but lately, according to Netflix, you know, they're not real forthcoming with their numbers, but according to Netflix, that show, Suits, has become one of the most popular shows on Netflix. Anecdotally, I know many people who are obsessed with that show now. So again, we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What shows are you always able to go back and rewatch? Do you have a comfort show you go back to from time to time? What makes it hold up? Have you gone to an older show and found that it didn't hold up? Or have you found something that was on back then, you didn't see it then, but you love it now? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Going to give a little listen to this show, Suits. Now, our producers, they're watching a lot of these old shows. Rochelle says, I watched Suits when it originally aired on USA Network in the early 2010s. So she was ahead of the curve here. And a part of the rewatch craze right now, USA was getting to be known around that time for a solid lineup of original drama/comedies, and action shows like Royal Pains and Burn Notice. Okay, so here's a clip that Rochelle picked for us from Suits. Hotshot lawyer Harvey Specter comes to the apartment of his protege, Mike Ross, who's a fake lawyer practicing law without a degree.
It's a nice building. How long ago was it condemned?
Oh, great. So did you come all the way over here just to criticize where I live, or...
That's a side benefit. Get your tux on. We got a situation.
a situation that requires a tux. Where is this tuxedo situation?
Atlantic City. Can you get dressed now?
Yeah, I could.
But?
I don't have a tux. I'm not Bruce Wayne.
Don't I know it?
Clip from Suits. Now let's go to your calls and Facebook comments. Call in at 800-642-1234 with your rewatchable TV shows. Owen starts us off in Milwaukee. Owen, hi.
Hello, hi.
What's your show, Owen?
Doctor Who. Big Doctor Who fan.
Okay. Now, I got to ask, which Doctor Who? Because you got about, so what, 60, 70 years of back catalog you could work through there?
Hey, I love them all. I've seen pretty much most of the episodes at this point, especially the newer series that started in 2005.
Who was your entry point Doctor? Because for people who don't know Doctor Who, it's been around forever. It's a science fiction show, and there's a conceit in the show where a different actor can play the main character over the years. Who did you come in on, Owen?
I started with a new series. I thought like going to the back to the old series would be a little bit too daunting. Just because I wasn't used to it yet. So I started a new series, started with Nine, played by Christopher Eccleston. And I got hooked on it.
All right, Owen. And you rewatch some episodes too? Or do you just keep digging and digging through that catalog?
I tend to rank episodes, and those like top five, top 10 episodes I've seen at least like five times each, if not more.
Oh, and I should ask, how are you watching it? Does a streaming service have everything, or are you having to track down DVDs, or how are you watching Doctor Who?
I used to do it at a library where I'd pick up like some of the DVDs, but yeah, and mainly HBO Max, I believe, has the whole catalog at this point. I know Doctor Who might be on Disney Plus soon, but HBO Max currently has all the new series.
All right. Well, you're set for life on that one. There's a lot to watch. Owen, thanks a lot for calling in at 800-642-1234, asking you to share the shows that you rewatch maybe once, maybe again and again, or an older show that you didn't watch when it was around. Maybe it was before you were born even, that you have watched and enjoyed or not. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. A bunch of people have done that. Gabe writes, The Sopranos, still the GOAT. That's youth slang, greatest of all time. Now, that's an interesting one. Because I think of a show like The Wire, right? That's like prestige TV. If you said, Rob, you got to pick one best show of all time, I might say The Wire. Would I go back and watch it again? I don't know. It's kind of painful to watch sometimes. Like a lot of bad stuff happens to sympathetic characters along the way. So that's interesting. I don't know. The prestige TV, I don't know if it always is something you want to rewatch. Correct me if I'm wrong. 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. B is with us in Prairie du Chien. B, hello.
Hi. Mad Men. Loved it. Didn't watch it when it first came out, but we loved it off of Netflix.
Okay, so you didn't watch it the first time through. What is it that made you say, okay, I should go check the show? Was it just hearing from your friends about it?
Yeah, everybody kept talking about it and how great it was, and I missed out on something good, and I think they were correct.
Now, this is one of those shows, there's a lot like this, where my wife and I start watching, I kind of fizzle out, she keeps watching and watching, she really loved it. What about it would you say to encourage me to pick it up again, B?
I liked it because of all of the side stories that went into the program. And you almost actually felt like when the last episode aired, you still wonder about the people, you know, all the characters, and wondering what they're still doing in the show. You know, it's kind of one of those thought processes.
Interesting, B. Thanks a lot for calling in at 800-642-1234. We'll go to Anne now in Waldo. Anne, what's your show?
Twilight Zone.
Now, the original, there have been a couple reboots of the Twilight Zone over the years. Are you talking original Rod Serling Twilight Zone?
Well, I'm talking the original, but I just started watching the newer stuff, and it's pretty good.
All right. There are three words, Anne, that give me chills if I think about it while I'm driving the car. Those three words are going my way. You know what I'm talking about?
Yes, I do. That's a scary one.
I don't even want to think about it right now.
Yeah, my favorite one is the one where the aliens attack the old woman's house and she beats them with a broom. And then when they leave, you see it's a spaceship from the United States of America. So she's killed all these astronauts from the United States. It's a great one. But yeah, it's a great show. It's got great twists, very well written. Even though it's, you know, years ago, it really is just ageless. It's great.
Excellent, and thanks a lot for that recommendation. Spoiler alert on that last one, though. We are taking your calls with your favorite TV shows to either rewatch or maybe a show that you missed when it was around. Maybe it was before your time, and you discovered it and loved it or hated it. You can join in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Monique is with us now in Plainfield. What's your show, Monique?
Hi, Gunsmoke.
Okay, now
there's the reason that Gunsmoke ran for 20 years.
It had a long run. Now, did you grow up with Gunsmoke, or did you come back to it from a later era?
No, it's well before my time, but with the invention of DVR, and you can just record all those old shows, and my husband and I binge watch at least 3 episodes a day.
Now, it's an old Western. What is it that you and your husband, like, what is it that you love about Gunsmoke?
It's kitschy, and it's sometimes silly, but the actors and actresses do a very good job of convincing you that they are Festus or, you know, Matt Dillon. So.
Excellent, Monique. Gunsmoke. Yeah, that's another one. Once you get into it, you've got 20 years of watching ahead of you. Well, I guess you can binge it a lot faster than that, though. Todd is with us now in Mount Horeb. You got a couple shows for us, Todd. What do you got?
Actually, I have a couple of awards. I love Green Acres and the Batman with Adam West. Both of them were just ridiculous then, play on words, running gags through the shows. I think both of those are just hilarious. I think they held up pretty well, too.
They were in syndication when I was a kid. I think they were from the 60s originally, but the time they were on TV in reruns was after I got home from school, I think, Todd. That's how I grew up with them and remember pretty fondly. Who's your favorite old Batman TV show villain?
Actually, I like Mr. Freeze.
Oh.
And you hardly see those anymore when they MeTV has them on after monster movies, but you never see Mr. Freeze much. He's my favorite.
All right, Todd, thanks a lot for sharing that with us. Katie joins us now in Milwaukee. Katie, what do you like to watch again?
I will watch Gilmore Girls over and over every season. I just love it so much.
Now, what is it? So this is what I'll admit I have not watched at all, but I know a lot of people who love the show. What is it you love about the show or the characters that keeps you coming back?
To be honest, I hated it when I first watched it, and then over time, I grew to love them. I became addicted. I will rewatch it every fall and every winter. They're just lovable, and some of them you love to hate.
And do you have, like, a community of friends you talk about Gilmore Girls with, or is this just a Katie solo experience?
I do. My sister-in-law watches it as well as her dogs. It is their soothing thing that they will not bark at, that they put on the TV when they're gone.
Awesome. Dogs love Gilmore Girls. Lesson to pet owners out there. Katie, thanks for the call. We are hearing from you right now about your favorite TV shows to revisit, maybe on streaming, DVD, or reruns. What do you think holds up about it? Or is there a show that everybody was watching back then you didn't watch till later? I did that with Twin Peaks, actually. I missed it when it was on, but I heard somebody overheard somebody talking about a key plot twist there. Who did it? And when I watched it years later, I already knew the answer. It was still a fun watch. You could join in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation, hear from you maybe, coming up on Central Time. See the money almost done. Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're taking your calls about older TV shows that you've just gotten into or shows that you rewatch. The theme from Suits there, which prompted this discussion, a lesser known show that's found new life, apparently. Big life on Netflix. You could join in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page a show that you love to rewatch or an older show that you discovered more recently. 800-642-1234 is the number. Kevin joins us now in Milwaukee. Kevin, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What's your show? Man,
my show is always the original Star Trek.
All right. Now, I had some Next Generation era stuff I was into. What is it about the original Kirk edition of Star Trek?
Oh, the reason I like it because I always like how Bones and Leonard Nimoy playing Spock was always after one another. You know, he has his logic and Bones have his realistic, and they just bicker back and forth all the time, but yet they enjoy one another.
Excellent, Kevin. Thanks a lot. The original Star Trek, just a few seasons of that. I guess some movies, too. Michael is with us now in Milwaukee with, I think, some more science fiction, too. Michael, hi.
Hi, yeah. So my thing as a kid was Stargate SG-1. Obviously, you know, I love the sci-fi. I love the premise and all the cast, especially Richard Dean Anderson. You know, he's a great actor. And then nowadays, though, I actually just enjoy watching Family Guy on reruns on TV.
I want to ask about Stargate, because that was one you said you watched as a kid. Do you go back and watch it? Does it hold up? Because sometimes those things you loved when you're young, it's hit or miss whether you're going to like them.
I think the nostalgia effect is good, and watching it back. Obviously, you know, when you go back and watch older stuff, you're just like, wow, that's really old. And back then, it used to feel so amazing and like new, and like the graphics were great and everything. You know, going back, it doesn't hold up as well, but it's still enjoyable.
Awesome, Michael. Thanks for sharing those with us. Liz joins us in Holman. Liz, hello.
Hi.
What shows did you want to bring up?
Well, there's two, actually. Of course, MASH is kind of like a good old familiar hug every time that comes on. I love to watch it. But I really love watching Battlestar Galactica, another sci-fi. And, I mean, the newer episodes, not the original series that came out, but the newer ones.
I got to say, Liz, I watched the newer Battlestar Galactica. I liked it. And then in the last season, I watched a few episodes, and then I fizzled out. Should I go back? Should I complete it?
I think you should. Yeah, it was kind of a little bit of a problem where people were like, oh, I don't know if I like the way it ended. And I'm like, it ended just fine. I loved it. And I will be 100% honest. I was so wrapped up in those characters that when it ended, I had family coming over. They were coming in late that night from out of town. And they walked in the door, and there was 10 minutes left of the show, and they started talking to me, and I shushed them really quick, and I said, be quiet.
Excellent. Thanks a lot for sharing that with us, Liz. We are taking your calls and comments with old TV shows you love to watch or shows you like to watch again and again, whether they're old or new, on Facebook. Joe, it says another vote for Gunsmoke there. Jocelyn writes, everybody loves Raymond. That Marie, Jocelyn says, she was so funny. Back to your calls. Mark joins us in Bloomer. Mark, what's your show?
Welcome back, Totter. 100%. Oh. Because I was like Arnold Horshack. I can relate.
I guess Arnold Horshack is probably the closest kid I was to that. Now, this is weird that you say that, Mark, because I was talking to one of my childhood friends the other day, and his wife lately just went nuts for watching Welcome Back, Kotter again. This is a show from the 70s, I'm going to say. I only have distant, vague memories of it. What made you either get into it or pick it back up?
I can totally relate. That was me in high school. I was one of the sweat hogs.
Awesome, Mark. Thanks a lot for the call. Bill joins us now in Lake County, Illinois. Bill, what show are you going back to?
I like Have Gun, Will Travel with Richard Boone.
And was that a Western? That's what I've never seen. Was that a Western?
Oh, yeah. He was the Western version of James Bond, in my opinion.
Oh, that's right. Okay. Yeah, I haven't seen it, but that was kind of the gist I got. This is like almost a superhero of the Old West, kind of.
Yes, exactly right.
All right.
Just another one I like to watch on YouTube is the old Ernie Kovacs show.
Oh, that's going back pretty far. All right, Bill, thanks for the recommendations. We've got Mike joining us now in Sheboygan. Mike, hello.
Hi. Monty Python's Flying Circus. It's the only show that our senior class would get together in the library. And it's the only time some of my senior class members would ever go to the library was the night after Monty Python's Flying Circus, because we just enjoyed it so much and we'd laugh. And the movies were fabulous too. Life of Brian, and it's just, the humor is just, it's timeless.
And Mike, do you go back and watch, you're watching in the library or talking about in the library in high school. Do you watch episodes now?
I don't have any access to episodes now, but The Life of Brian was one of the, I went to a religious college, and some of the ministers would laugh so hard at that movie because it was just so irreverent of everything. And it's just, it's got such, I mean, at the time, the humor is beautiful.
Well, it's got a great message for Wisconsin, right, Mike? Blessed are the cheesemakers.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Thanks a lot for that call, Mike, at 800-642-1234. Taking your calls on great old shows to watch, or old or new shows that you watch again and again, maybe a comfort show. Still time, a line opened up if you hit a busy signal earlier at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Paul is with us now in Milwaukee. Paul, hi.
Hey, how you doing, Rob?
Good. What do you like to watch?
Hey, I tell you, I really love the watching Jack Benny, his TV show, and all the spooky shows that came, like, you know, Alfred Hitchcock and all the things like that that examine cultural issues and explore them through the metaphor, sometimes of horror, sometimes of comedy. And I know that so many of these had their basis in radio. And I remember, you know, it's, you would see those, they made the transfer into the 50s and 60s into popular culture television. But I think the saddest and spookiest thing is when you guys used to have an old time radio show every Sunday, and my love and I would listen to it. And then it got canceled because people thought it was racist and sexist. But I think it was really called old time radio for a reason. And it was a wonderful basis to have that. I think that should never have been canceled.
Paul, thanks for calling in. Andy joins us now in Milwaukee. Andy, what are you watching?
Oh, I'm watching Moonlighting now that it's on streaming, and I'm really loving it.
Andy, I keep seeing stuff about Moonlighting lately. Now, that's the Bruce Willis, Cybill Shepherd show from, what, the 80s. Did it just come out on streaming? Because I keep seeing people writing about it.
It did. It just came out on Hulu. They had one of these fabled rights issues, I think, with a lot of the music. It took a while to get it on to streaming, and so they're finally there, and I'm just loving it.
And there's that the famous Shakespeare episode. Have you gone back and watched that one yet?
Yes, The Taming of the Shrew. I didn't get to it yet, but that's the one that definitely occupies a lot of my brain right now. I can hardly wait to get to it.
Excellent.
But smartly written, and actually, really, the early episodes seem to be very film noirish, which I don't really remember. A lot of funny, but also a lot of very L.A. grit. So it's great.
Interesting. Andy, thanks a lot for the call. Time for a couple few more callers. Doug is with us in Egg Harbor. Doug, hi.
Yeah, hey, I haven't heard MASH yet, or was I maybe out of the vehicle? And
I think you might have been calling it. Somebody did mention MASH, but you could second MASH for sure. And you have another one, Doug?
Yeah, the Andy Griffith Show, and there is always a life lesson in every half hour or so. And a half hour took like 25 minutes to watch it. It wasn't full of commercials.
Excellent, Doug. Thanks for the suggestions. Tracy joins us in Rice Lake. Tracy, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to recommend, Tracy?
The George Byrne and Gracie show and all four of Lucy Arnaz's shows.
Okay. Where do you watch the George Burns and Gracie Allen show these days?
They actually are on Tubi.
Oh, wow. You can find just about everything out there. Thank you for that, Tracy. I didn't know that. Kimberly joins us now in Madison. Kimberly, hi.
Hey there. The Expanse. Thanks to Meghna Chakravarti talking about it on, what was it? On Point.
On Point, yeah. Now, I have watched The Expanse. I've read many of the books. Did you come in with the books first or the TV show?
I did not. No, it was after the interview discussion, and I thought it was so apropos. So I watched it, and I binged the crap out of it. So now I'm sad after watching all six seasons.
Yeah, it ends a little abruptly. I feel like they got canceled halfway through or something and had to come to a quick conclusion. But Kimberly, thanks. Time for one more quick call. Roger is with us in DeForest. Roger, hi.
Yeah, double up on Marty Python's Flying Circus. In college, we used to go to the Memorial Union. There was a whole bunch of people would show up, and we'd listen to it and watch it there. There was also a radio program with the same type of humor. I don't know what it was called. Terry Gilligan and a whole bunch.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay. I thought you were going to maybe say Fire Sign Theater. That was in the same kind of spirit, I think, as Monty Python, but it was a radio show. Roger, thanks a lot. Thanks to everybody who called in. There is still time for you to share that rewatchable TV show. Head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page. Tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, state lawmakers are digging into truancy in Wisconsin schools. A commission will try to find out why kids don't show up at school. Check out the problem and solutions tomorrow morning at 7:30. I can't eat spicy food like I used to could because of, you know, reasons, but I do understand why people like spicy stuff. If you are a fan of extreme heat in your food, there's a new pepper in town made just for you. As reported by NPR, there's a new Guinness record holder for the spiciest pepper in the world. It's called Pepper X. It was bred by the Pucker Butt Pepper Company in South Carolina. Can I say that? Which also developed the previous record holder, the Carolina Reaper. Now, I saw a picture, not a lot to look at. Small, wrinkly, and yellow-green, but on that Scoville heat unit scale that measures the spiciness of peppers, it clocks in at 2.693 million. Compare that to a jalapeno, which tops out at maybe 8,000. So would I ever try Pepper X? That is a definite no. Too hot for radio. This is Central Time.